Hi everyone, and welcome to The Wealth Show. I'm Zach, a senior reporter at Citywire Wealth Manager. I'm joined today by fellow reporter Natalia Vaznier, and today we are talking about the maturing MPS sector and whether we have reached peak MPS. Joining us today is James Sullivan, Head of Partnerships at Tindall Investment Management. James, thank you so much for joining us today.
You're very welcome. Hi Zach, hi Natalia.
Natalia wrote a fantastic article last month on the sharp drop in MPS launches since 2022, with just one MPS launch in the first half of this year, according to a Morningstar report. James, why do you think we're seeing this drop, and have we reached peak MPS?
So in a word, yes, I think we have reached peak MPS. The market, in my opinion, has become saturated. The number of MPS launches and providers, I think, is overwhelming the demand. If we consider that the demand is actually diminishing because there's great consolidation within the IFA community, the IFA community, of course, is probably the biggest buyer of the MPS proposition. So the demand has not sort of followed through with the limited demand that the IFA industry is now sort of providing. So I do think the market is saturated, and yes, I do think we've hit peak MPS for sure.
I just had a question about competitive, because there's so many providers in the market space. Because we talk a lot about price wars, like the race to the bottom, which is kind of very negative in the space. So how do you feel like providers can remain competitive? If they can,
it's a really good question, because I think the MPS industry as a whole is pretty sterile. Most providers, in my opinion, are doing something very, very similar to each other. Therefore, no one really has a USP. So the best way that most providers have been able to compete is on price. So we've seen a race to the bottom, and some of the biggest players in the market, the household names, are now offering MPS at 10 or even sub 10 basis points, no VAT, of course, these days. And in truth, some of the smaller players who don't have the critical mass or the client base won't be able to compete at 10 basis points. And they will have a decision to make how they pivot their business to a more sustainable model, if indeed they are able to.
Where do you think that would go then? Because as you said, you don't believe they've got there's a clear USP and that they are going to have to pivot their business models. Where do you see that sustainability? Do you think we'll potentially just lose out on a lot of, model portfolio services?
Yeah. Look, if there's a choice to be had, there was a subscale DFM offering MPS and they were struggling to compete, they've got a decision to make. Either they sort of consolidate away, they sell themselves or similar. Or indeed, they go out and follow the trajectory that many others have followed, which is to actually acquire advisory businesses. So you essentially bring distribution in-house. That is obviously the vertically integrated model that many have chosen to follow. So that is the choice, Zach, really. It's whether they have the appetite and indeed the financial firepower to go down that route.
Yeah, it's interesting linking this to sort of wider IFA consolidation as well. I mean, obviously, as Natalia's article sort of showed, if you look at the way the market is going, you can sort of see it in data. But on the ground, speaking to IFAs, perhaps IFAs who haven't been consolidated, does this tally with what they're telling you?
Yeah, look, I think IFAs that have not consolidated away are fiercely independent, and they are incredibly passionate about what they do. And what I mean by that is what they do is twofold typically. One is the financial planning aspect of their role. The second aspect is the investment management of their role. Finding a firm to outsource the investment management piece to for that ilk of clients is a very, very considered decision, because it's like giving your baby away. They won't give it away easily. And I think they are increasingly selective about which DFM or MPS provider that they do partner with.
Yes, I just kind of wanted to jump on that. And we've been talking with quite a few people within the space who've been saying that there'll be new launches, but they won't be able to scale and that they would remain subscale. Would you agree with that statement? Because I think it's an interesting point to make.
I do. And I've been saying to anyone who'd listen, really, that for a business to be sustainable, it has to be scalable. And whether that's the adoption of different AI integration, or indeed whether it is the next evolution of the MPS industry, feels like it's a unitization of the proposition, which almost harks back to the early days of a fund of funds. We kind of, Zach, you said at the start, how did we kind of get here? we got here because the industry, the marketplace grew tired of fund of funds because the perception of fees on fees was unpalatable. MiFID II put a little bit more light on, you know, the fees involved. And therefore, the unbundled nature of the MPS appeared to be, on the surface, cheaper. Less tax benefits, but explicitly cheaper. Therefore, it was more palatable for most advisors. We're now having a lot of talk within the industry that MPS providers are now considering unitizing their proposition. A unitized MPS is kind of like a fund of funds, but it just sounds a little bit cooler. So we are almost going full circle. That might give some MPS providers a little bit more scalability, because in truth, running an MPS is quite operationally heavy. You know, there's a lot of work involved behind the scenes that isn't just investment related. It's the rebalancing, it's managing money on various platforms, making sure there's consistency of share classes across platforms. You know, there's a lot that goes on below the tip of the iceberg that is operationally cumbersome, and finding a solution to that piece will pretty much provide an MPS provider with the answers of scalability.
Yeah, that's a really interesting point. And you sort of touched on regulation there as well. I mean, obviously that's had a factor in the sort of growth and now potential peak of MPS. I just wanted to ask if, you know, because looking deeper into Natalia's article, you know, in terms of the backdrop of how MPS has been performing, and we've seen that, you know, some ESG assets have some very poor performance, you know, recently. I wondered what your thoughts were there towards the regulatory impact. You know, we're seeing confusion about SDR labels at the moment for ESG, and we're seeing a sort of we're seeing a sort of hype, the end of a sort of hype, really, or ESG. I wonder what your thoughts were towards that.
Yeah, so even say 2-3 years ago, certainly pre say November 21, which from memory is when we sort of hit the peak ESG bubble. You know, that's when ESG then started rolling over and it sort of deflated. But up until then, a lot of clients of ours were demanding a standalone sustainable or ESG suite of models, typically alongside a traditional suite of models. They would then give their clients the choice, which one do they want? Do they want to invest ethically and sustainably, or do they, you know, not care so much, and then they just want to sort of generate as much profit as they can? What we found over the last couple of years is because the sustainable universe has performed so poorly, clients are now saying, look, let's not have a standalone offering, but maybe just integrate some ESG and sustainable funds within your traditional models so that we can offer clients a blend. And it's quite interesting. Of course, we've been blending active with passive to bring the fees down. Now it feels like increasingly we're blending sustainable with core to have a sort of a mix of values within a portfolio, which I personally think is probably the right way to proceed.
And presumably that helps to insure you against market volatility.
It does. We know that investing sustainably, I know it's a relatively immature asset class, but we know that what we have seen over the last few years is that investing sustainably at the sharper end of the green spectrum does come with heightened volatility. And I'm not sure every investor fully understood that when they decided to invest in line with their values. And it was a bit of a shock to the system, certainly in 2022, when the whole ESG phenomena sort of unraveled.
Yeah, absolutely. And I did like have a question about regulations, and with the budget coming up, do you feel like there's any concerns about a potential CGT hike and how that would impact the industry? Because I know we had the CEO summit a few weeks ago and somebody was saying how if there was a hike up to 45%, then it would lead to people moving away from MPS and back towards funds. What do you think about that?
Yeah, so to keep it in context, the MPS proposition has had a massive tailwind in the last 10, 15 years. You know, it's benefited massively for MiFID and MiFID II, as I say, the unbundling of fees. So this is the first time it's really faced a real material headwind. The CGT allowance in isolation coming down to £3,000 per annum has been a big body blow. And if the actual tax rate goes up as well on the 30th of October, it'll be a second shoe to drop in that instance. We are finding, obviously, most of the money that we manage on behalf of clients is still within a tax wrapper. It's within a SIP or it's within an ISA. So therefore, that whole conversation is slightly less relevant. But monies that are still managed within GIAs, general investment accounts, of course, are susceptible to tax. And we are increasingly seeing clients ask whether there is a unitized version of the proposition that they can hold in GIAs. So any trades we do are within the tax structure, the tax efficient structure of the fund. So that is an evolution. And I think if there is a hike in the CGT rate, then it's only going to further fuel that fire.
And it's interesting, you, I mean, perhaps jumping earlier just a bit back to what you said about blending. And of course, we are seeing a sort of growing dominance of, you know, passive and a drop in, I believe it was the percentages in that 2022 Morningstar study, Natalia, that MPS portfolios that were labeled active fell from 61% back then, now they're 48%. I just wanted to ask you about the future of active management and whether you can see, whether you think that'll hold steady or whether you can see a slight decline.
I can see a continued decline. I think if we just take a step back and we consider the entire fee chain that the end client pays, so Mrs. Jones, there are four elements to that. There is the IFA fee, so the fee for the advisory, the relationship management. There's the platform fee. There's the DFM or MPS fee. And then there's the underlying portfolio fee. Unfortunately, for the guys that are part of that portfolio, they are the bottom of the food chain because they're at the mercy of the DFM deciding what that's going to be. Nobody higher up the chain really wants to sacrifice their own fee. So it means the OCF on the underlying portfolio is getting continually squeezed. 2-3 years ago, I would suggest that all-in fee, so the advisor fee, the platform fee, the DFM fee, and the OCF had to come in below 200 basis points, 2%. That's now much closer to 1.75, 1.7. So that cost pressure is not going away and it's only increasing. So I do think there is going to be a continued move towards passive investing, or active fees need to come down significantly from where they are to compete with passive fees. They don't need to be pari passu, but they need to come down. You know, active fund OCFs can no longer be 1 point something. At worst, they've got to be 0.8, 0.75 to even be considered, which is where we are as an industry.
And do you feel like that might be a possibility that active fees will be able to decline?
It has to be, is my answer. Otherwise, you know, you adapt or you die sort of thing. If they don't and they're too stubborn, and there'll be some chief execs of active management houses who say, oh, no, this is going to swing back the other way. It's not. Those guys will die because they're too stubborn to move their pricing. The guys that will thrive are the guys that are going to double their AUM but half their margins. You know, that's just the state of the economics that we face. That's the decision that we face as an active industry.
Yeah, and of course, you know, much has been made about keeping advisors happy in all this. You know, advisors love their independence. They you know, care about their independence and can get quite unhappy when being told what to do, to put it frankly. What are your thoughts on how MPS providers can sort of retain that communication with their advisor and retain the, you know, amount of choice that they get?
So my interpretation of this is that advisors, typically the ones that have remained independent that you referred to, Zach, I said already they're very, very passionate about what they do. They want a seat at the table. They don't necessarily need to control what's going on, but they want a voice. They want an MPS provider or a DFM partner that brings a little bit of personality to the proposition. Because again, I said earlier that the MPS proposition off the shelf is a very sterile proposition. If we consider what one of the key aspects of consumer duty is, it's putting the onus on the advisor to be able to justify value add. Buying a sterile MPS off the shelf arguably is difficult to prove that explicit value is being added if everyone else is doing the same thing. So one way of proving value, I think, is to have an MPS partner that brings personality. What I mean by that is there's a line of engagement, a line of communication, a quarterly or a half yearly investment committee that is held exclusively for that IFA in their office, telling them what's going on, why it's going on, so that the IFA can then relay that information to the end client. It makes the IFA, in the eyes of their client, look very, very important. They know exactly what's going on, why and when, rather than simply saying, oh, I've taken your money and I've given it to, you know, the shop up the road, and I'll let you know what they're doing when they send me a valuation. You know, we need to be better as an MPS sector at collaboration with the IFA, with collaboration with our clients. I think up until now, there are some players in the market who have taken it for granted. But clearly, we have to be better.
Do you think there's an appetite for that from IFAs? Because, you know, that's, you're saying that we need to be better as a sector in terms of communicating with them. Has that been taken for granted?
So I think the appetite is there to answer the first question. And so, yes, up until now, I think it's been taken for granted because it's been quite an easy sell. You know, the MPS market has raised billions and billions of pounds. And really, it's just sat back and taken the money. Now it's becoming more competitive. The market itself is shrinking because the independent IFAs are less than what they once were. The MPS market now has to do a little bit more to earn its keep. And as I say, that includes bespoking MPS, white labeling fact sheets, hosting investment committees on behalf of the client, and, you know, hosting webinars for the IFA's clients in turn, really becoming essentially a quasi in-house DFM. You know, you need to be on the phone 24/7 or available on the phone 24/7 to your IFA partner. You need to be willing to get in the car tomorrow and go and see them if they've got an issue. You need to be able to communicate very clearly what you're doing, why you're doing it, and when you're doing it. So they're not in the dark. They need to be seen in the eyes of their client that they are so important to the entire process that their relationship is evergreen with their client and it's super sticky. And we can help the IFA underpin their relationships by providing that bespoke engagement.
Talking back about like performance of active, why do you feel like that has been happening over time? Because I feel like active management is what people kind of prefer because you kind of have a more hands-on approach rather than following the index.
I think people want active to thrive, but unfortunately active has, it feels like, underwhelmed in the recent past. You know, some of that is down, of course, to the concentration of the Magnificent Seven in the States. You know, the Magnificent Seven are 31.5% or so of the S&P 500, and they have basically driven 110% of the performance of the S&P 500. So if an active manager didn't have at least 31.5% of the Mag 7 in their portfolio, the chances are they would have underperformed. It's been, I would say, a very, very difficult environment for active managers to thrive. That's not an excuse. It's sort of like a fact. You know, I'm style agnostic. I don't really mind if I buy passive or active. So I've not got a dog in the fight. But active managers have struggled, it does feel, more recently than perhaps they had done in the past. Of course, with a fee of 75 to 100 basis points on an active fund, you compound that over 2-3 years against a fee on an index fund of, say, 15 basis points. You know, that adds up. That's 2-4% over 4 or 5 years. That's a significant drag on the performance of the fund. That's why I said earlier, Zach, that the differential in pricing, it needs to be less polarized. It needs to narrow to allow the active managers to at least compete on a level playing field when it comes to performance.
Mm. And of course, you know, you mentioned there about, you know, a personalized touch and greater communication with IFAs, but ultimately it's about performance as well. So if you're performing well, your IFA is going to be very happy regardless. And that links to the sort of active passive with, you know, passive performing better at the moment.
I agree. I say this glibly, but you can kind of get away with quite a lot if you're performing very well. Performance clearly matters. There are two things that really matter: performance and price. Everything else is a fringe benefit, but if you get those two things right, you're going to have a very, very happy client. Those are the key tacits of a, you know, successful DFM.
And you were mentioning about personality, and in a recent interview, you were saying how the MPS space was actually lacking personality. Maybe could you just explain a bit what you meant by that?
Yeah, it's quite subjective, isn't it? I know I say a lot of things, Natalia, and sometimes I need to think about what I meant by it, but The original MPS proposition was a firm would build a suite of models, you know, 1 to 5, 1 to 7, and they put them on every platform and just expect people to buy them. A bit like when we used to run funds, you'd do the same. You'd run a fund, you'd put it on platform and people would come to you. There was no interface. You know, you didn't really know what was going on behind the fact sheet. The differentiator, I think, for the successful guys going forward will be the amount of personality they bring. What do I mean by that? I really just mean that client engagement. They need to be able to show up as well. I think half the battle is turning up, you know, even when the performance is less good. That's when your client needs to see you in their office to reassure them that you know what you're doing and why you're underperforming. It's the personality that any firm brings is really our only USP. That is our only USP, I think, in a very saturated market.
Sort of lastly, I mean, we mentioned regulation briefly before. I wondered what your thoughts were towards the future of this space and how that's going to be impacted by what the FCA decides to do. I mean, you know, we've seen the regulators sort of having this approach with MPS that, as I think it's fair to say, allowed for their growth, continued growth. I just wondered what your thoughts were, what your thoughts were towards regulatory action in the near future.
Yeah, I've always got to be careful when I talk about regulation, because of course, you know, they're watching over all of us all the time. But any regulation that is unveiled by the FCA or others is obviously done with good intentions. And it's always done with the end client's interests at heart. Doesn't always make it easy to stomach. And typically there are costs associated with then integrating that regulation into your, you know, your working practices. I don't know what the next evolution of regulation will be. Obviously, we've just gone through quite a big one with Consumer Duty. We probably haven't seen the end of it. We've got the SDR labels that you referred to, Zach, coming down the line, although my understanding is that's been pushed back. There's still a great deal of uncertainty over how that's going to look and feel. You know, the regulation then before that was MiFID II, that really did lead to the demise of the fund of funds or the multi-asset offering. And that was the trigger for MPS. I don't know where we go from here, but what I do know is that good businesses will be able to move with the times. They will be able to move with regulation, and they'll be able to continue to give the client what the client wants. And I think that's really, really important. I know, again, this is pretty glib, but the key to a successful relationship is you give the client what they want. And if a business is nimble enough to be able to do that, then good luck to them. They'll absolutely knock it out of the park.
When I was doing some research about Tindal, you were saying that you kind of offer an alternative solution to MPS. I think it could be interesting if you kind of talk through that.
Yeah, so I, without boring on about my own journey, I joined Tindal 4 years ago, something like that. And I sat down with Alex Odd, who's our chief exec. And up until that point, I'd pretty much run fund of funds my whole career, for pretty much 20 years up until then. And I said to Alex, look, I think there's a better way of delivering a multi-asset solution to the IFA industry. But I said, it's not a conventional MPS. And Alex was like, well, that's really interesting, but what is it? You know, can you give me a clue? And I said, well, it's like a bespoke MPS. It's where we run exclusive MPS for IFA firms that are willing to commit to us as much as we're willing to commit to them. So every firm we work for, we give them everything we've got. You know, exclusive suite of models. We'll call the models whatever they want them to be called. They'll be on a platform of their choice. They'll be priced accordingly to suit the business model of the IFA. And we'll go to their office every quarter and host an investment committee. That is what we believe to be doing MPS, but doing it better. It's taking the sterileness of the MPS, because at its core, there's nothing really wrong with it. As I say, it just lacked personality and lacked a USP. And we're trying to give it a USP. We're trying to give it some personality. We're trying to make the IFA feel much more engaged than perhaps they had done in the past. And we're trying to make the IFA feel they are much more empowered in front of their own clients.
And has that been a successful kind of strategy for you so far?
It has. You know, it hasn't been easy, but we started this journey 4 years ago with no clients, no AUM within this team. And we've grown it now to just shy of 1 billion and about 18 or 19 IFA relationships. So in the grand scheme of this industry, that's still obviously very, very small. But from a standing start and working with a select number of IFAs rather than mass markets, you know, we're comfortable with the growth that we've displayed. But of course, you're only as good as your next, you know, quarter, your next 6 months. We need to kick on, and we would love to continue to grow the franchise, but not at the expense of losing the personal touch that we've built the first £1 billion on.
Mm. Did you have, again, not at the expense of, you know, losing that personal touch, but did you have any targets in mind for partnerships that you'd like to have in the next, say, 5 years?
No, and I'm always sort of guarded against giving any answer because I know it'll be horribly wrong. But what we will do is if we onboard, let's say, another 5 IFA relationships over the next 6 to 12 months, we'll make sure we resource it accordingly and the team will be increased accordingly to make sure that we don't drop the ball and we continue to provide that personalized service. That's the key ingredient here. People say to me, but bespoke MPS isn't scalable. It is if you're willing to invest in it. Sure, it's not going to just grow margin exponentially because you don't just have a cost base and then you just pile on billions. We will grow the team as we grow the franchise. And that's only fair. That's fair to our IFA clients.
That seems like a great note to end on. James, thank you so much for coming in.
Very welcome. Thank you, guys.
Thank you, Natalia.
Thank you.
You've been listening to The Wealth Show with myself and wealth manager reporter Natalia Vaznier. Today we were joined by James Sullivan from Tyndall Investment Management. For any questions, please feel free to email us at wmnews@citywire.co.uk. Thank you so much for listening, and we'll see you next week.